Hello, everybody, and welcome to Ambiguous Borders. That was so dramatic for something that you've literally read. This is Ambiguous Borders podcast. I'm your host, Miles. With me, as always, is my co-host, Sevi.
Hello, everyone.
So we're going to be talking about Hokkaido today. This is the 33rd episode. I don't believe we've made 33 episodes of these, but... somehow we have.
We haven't made 33, Miles. We've made a lot more than 33. Remember all those banner banters?
Do you remember all the ones that we didn't release because they were so bad?
There's been less than 33 of those, though.
Yeah, there have been less than 33 of those, fortunately. So we're going to be talking about Hokkaido today.
Where's Hokkaido, Miles? I've not heard this word before.
Transport ourselves to the West Pacific, I guess. Do you call it that? Asia, I guess.
I think that's more likely. And North, yeah. Japan.
Yeah, exactly. So we're in the country of Japan, I guess, for this. So have you been there?
I have not been to Hokkaido, and I have not been to Japan. have you been to Hokkaido?
Neither. Okay. So this is going to be exciting since we both haven't been there and are probably quite far away from
reality. Do you know anyone like from Japan or from like that type of culture?
Yeah, I know people from Japan. I also know people that have been there. I don't know if I know anyone that's been to Hokkaido specifically, though.
Okay.
How about you?
I have met people and I've talked to them about Japan who are from Japan, but I've not... Yeah, I don't have a close connection, if that makes sense. It's more like second, third order.
Okay, so how are we going to start this off? Are we going to say what the question is, or are we going to...
Let's talk about where it is. Let's make this fun. We'll go the regular thing.
Okay, so Hokkaido is one of four of Japan's main islands. They are Honshu, Kyushu, Shikoku, and... Hokkaido itself.
Which one is Tokyo on, the capital of Japan?
So that's on Honshu.
Okay.
Which is the biggest island. And then I think Hokkaido is the second biggest.
Yeah. And it's just north of the Honshu.
Yep. Yeah. It's got quite a funny shape. It's kind of like a diamond, I guess, mm-hmm. if you think about it. And then it has like a little outstretched arm that kind of like looks like it's trying to eat Honshu.
It's reaching out for Honshu. It's like they're holding hands, but doesn't quite make it.
Yeah, okay. We'll go with that. Yeah. So that's what we're going to be talking about today. Do you want to just tell me what the question is so we know what we're going to be deep diving into later so we can put ourselves in the frame of mind for what we've got to answer?
So why were the Hokkaido's Ainu people assimilated? So... the Ainu people, like, just little tidbit is it's like their native population that was there before, and kind of got colonized. Hokkaido, when I was reading about it, I got a lot of similarities between like the Western US. It's kind of like the Japanese people were more on Honshu and some of the other islands, and then they kind of progressed northward, kind of like, in the US, a lot of, colonists progressed westward.
He always brings it back to the U.S.
It's an example, right? It's more about, like, expansionism into Hokkaido is a good way of thinking about it. Expansion, colonization.
What excellent words. That's sarcasm, by the way, for those listening.
Yes.
So it's about 22% of Japan's land area.
Mm-hmm.
Interestingly, Hokkaido. They say it's, like, the biggest island, but... That's not actually true. So I don't know how they...
So they're... The Japan's split up into prefectures. There are 47 of them. And so like...
Yes.
And technically all of Hokkaido is one prefecture, which is really interesting. So it's the largest one in that way. And that's partly due to the fact that it's like more sparsely populated. Let's put it that way. Although it has started to get more populated recently.
Yeah, so the area is about 83,500 kilometers squared, which is about the same as Austria or the UAE.
So that's 32,000 square miles, or about the size of South Carolina.
Yeah. Okay. And the population you mentioned is getting, it's quite sparsely populated. Were you surprised to see how many or little it had? Which one? Did you think it was bigger than it was, or?
I don't remember.
Okay, so I didn't think it would have as many as it does.
Okay.
So it's got 5.3 million people, which is the same as Norway or Slovakia.
Yeah, and I also got like Costa Rica, and it's about 2 million people in Sapporo, the capital. And we haven't gone over that yet. Sapporo, the capital of Hokkaido. And then interestingly enough, it's about the same population Hokkaido is of South Carolina. So it's actually area and population are about the same as South Carolina.
Hokkaido is?
Yeah. It's interesting. Nice. This is the first time I've compared it to a U.S. perspective where both it's the same state for both population and area.
So did you know that Sapporo hosted the first Winter Olympics ever held in Asia?
I did not know that. I'm not terribly surprised, though, given Japan and Hokkaido being like the kind of the north, more wintry place in Japan.
But it's compared to the rest of Asia.
Yeah, Japan was more open to like, I'd say, Olympics and that style of like Western thing than other Asian countries first, wouldn't it have been?
Not necessarily. It was the 70s, so it could have been. There's a whole, a whole raft of countries that are not necessarily open today that would have been open then.
When did China open up to the West?
I mean, arguably it hasn't.
Okay, but in terms of trade, was that the?
Well, it was after Mao, right?
Right. So what decade would that have been in the 90s?
Yeah, 80s, late 80s, 90s.
Okay, so yeah, that's what I'm more thinking about from the Japan perspective.
But there's more than just in Asia than Japan and China. So Korea, for example, had probably been open for a longer time. You probably would have had examples there. Yeah. I mean, we're kind of.
I'm just thinking about like economically here, but, large, Asian countries. Cause,
but what about like Afghanistan, for example?
Yeah,
or Iran.
Yeah, but that's my point. My point is like usually countries that are doing the Olympics are more likely to be large economies. And I was thinking about of the large economies
like,
in Asia.
Like Iran, for example. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like Iran.
Have there been any Olympics in Iran?
No. Okay. But it was an example that in the 70s was a very different place to how you think about it now. Now it's more of a pariah state.
Yeah.
Compared to the West.
Compared to what it was in the 70s.
Booming. It was essentially, great trading partner of.
I'm not as familiar with what Iran was like in the 70s, so that's why I guess it didn't come over my head for Olympics.
Okay, and anyway, so they're actually currently bidding for the 2030 Winter Olympics as well.
Hokkaido.
So.
Or Sapporo?
Sapporo.
Sapporo.
Yeah. So what can you tell me about the climate, since we've sort of said that they can host some Winter Olympics?
Yeah, so the climate is colder and drier as well. In fact, the summers are really
colder and drier than what?
Than Honshu.
So it's the coldest and driest part of Japan.
Yeah, exactly. And in fact, like there's a lot of tourists who go to Hokkaido from all around the world. Like skiing's become a much bigger sport that people travel there for, but it's also a huge tourist destination for just Japanese as well. So a lot of people from like Tokyo area and the rest of Japan actually go up there in the summer to kind of cool down because it's a really nice summer climate of like just dry, like nice, easy temperature, not too hot, unlike the rest of Japan, which is hot and very hot and humid.
Yeah.
You want to cover the winters a little bit?
It's cold winters. So average January temperatures are kind of like between minus 12 and minus 4 degrees. Obviously, there is a lot of snow. It's one of the snowiest places in the world, I believe, in terms of like the meterage of snowfall you get. I think parts of South America are higher, but I think it is up there in the world for the highest. You kind of think about that classic like photo of like the buses that are going up on these carved, not carved roads, but snow-cleared roads, and the snow is higher than the buses themselves on either side. It's quite something.
They call it hemi-boreal climate. So you can think of like boreal climate, yeah. Like lots of snow. And that also goes along with like the skiing and lots of winter activities. There's lots of festivals that like some ice festivals and other like winter related festivals throughout Hokkaido.
Yeah. Okay, so that's a brief introduction to Hokkaido. Do you want to tell me some fun facts? Have you got anything up your sleeve?
Yeah. So one interesting thing is, so we've talked about the Ring of Fire before. This is like right on the Ring of Fire. In fact, the whole island was created through basically volcanic eruptions and being right on that fault plane. There's basically, you talked about the interesting shape. Actually, there's a lot kind of like lowlands around it, but then the center spine almost of the country is very mountainous, which I guess goes along with the winter sports we were talking about and is very volcanically active. It's also very active from an earthquake perspective. So in 1993, 2003, 2018, and 2021, they had earthquakes above a 6 on the Richter scale. So that's like 4 earthquakes in the last like 30 years that are above 6. So very tectonically active. In fact, there was like a 6.6 one that wiped out all the power on the island recently. So yeah, it's basically a volcanic plateau ring for the central mountains. And then fun facts. So we talked about how it's an island, and it's actually very close to the Honshu Island. And so there's a little bit of water there's a lot of water separating them. So a big problem has been like, how do people get back and forth between the two places? And there is actually the single longest tunnel undersea connecting the two islands.
How long is that?
It is a almost 54 kilometer tunnel. So that's 33 and a half miles. It's hard to, so let's see if I can get this right. So it's the longest undersea tunnel. So in terms of length, it's the longest tunnel. So it's longer than the Channel Tunnel, for instance, between England and mm-hmm. France. But the Channel Tunnel goes under more water. So in the end, like if you're, the section of tunnel that's underneath the water is longer for the Channel Tunnel. But this one, it's just longer overall. It's still a large section of water. It's just, it kind of like goes into the country a little bit further on both ends. If that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. This is all a railway tunnel, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, so this is part of the Shinkansen gauges and railways go through here.
Yeah, so it's very impressive in that sense. So I talked about travel between the two with that railroad line. There's another big, how do you think most people travel between the two islands in today's age?
You would arguably just guess planes.
Yes, right? So you are correct. It is one of the busiest one of the 10 busiest airline routes in the whole world. I think it's like, I should have known the exact number, but it's like, it might be like one or two. It's incredibly busy. So this specific route is Tokyo to Chitoshi. So Chitoshi airport, new airport, is kind of the airport right outside of Sapporo. So another thing is, apparently bears just walk in to Sapporo. That's like a common occurrence. So that gives you a sense of the wildness of the city. I looked up a bunch of different people, and people love living in Sapporo. It's a very international city, unlike maybe a lot of other Japanese cities, which is really interesting because it's got like lots of, like South Korea is just across the way. Russia's not too far by, so it's got a little bit more European influence. It's got the American influence as well. And then there's just a lot more like international people like living there, given the tourism industry as well. And then people also love it. The second reason people liked it a lot was from the perspective of like, you're literally like a 20-minute bus ride. You're like in the forests, you're in the mountains, you're in like, you're kind of out in nature, and hence the bears that walk into Sapporo.
Nice. Did you want to get into the question?
Yeah, I'll say two more things, which is okay. about the skiing, because it's very important, the skiing, of course. Miles hates to ski, so I'm sorry to bore him with these details. What do you think they call the... do you know what they... So I'm going to go over two Japanese words. One of them's probably, like, way more not Japanese than the other one. So one is for, like, the snow that comes down that people ski on. What do you think that... So you're... What do you think that's called?
Snow.
Okay, no. And then the other one is for the pools, like basically the hot pools, the hot springs that
the thermal springs. Yeah.
So but like they're usually in bathhouses like in the mountains, and it's a very so are you familiar with what those are called?
No.
So onsens. So onsens are, and this is very common even in Honshu and other parts of Japan too. It's very common like to get in these warm baths. It's a big part of the culture. Like I'd say the closest analogy is like a hot tub. But for us, it's like, oh, the hot tub's like, oh, maybe when you're on vacation or a special occasion. But we're there, it's like a lot more common as something you just do all the time. And that's a very common thing to do after you like do some winter activities in Hokkaido.
Yeah. It sounds like the sauna in Nordic countries, for instance.
Yeah. That's probably a good example.
Like Finland. Just a bit of a fun fact about onsens is that if you have tattoos, you're generally not allowed in. Sorry to all those listeners with tattoos. Yeah.
And it's pretty common for onsens, like you're completely nude. Is that's correct as well?
Yeah, I would say so.
So, and then the other word I was referring to before is japao. So Japan powder, japao. I feel like they could have been a little bit more Japanese with that. But yeah, that a lot of people are like, you got to go to Japan to get the Japao.
That's very American.
Yes, exactly. That's my point. Okay, so Miles, tell me in one sentence why Hokkaido's Ainu people were assimilated.
In one sentence. The use... the belief of Pan-Asianism and racial superiority led to the assimilation of the Ainu people.
Okay.
What's your one sentence?
My one sentence is, I guess I'll take it from the Anju perspective, which is the Anju call the ethnic Japanese Wajin, a term that originated in China, and it basically means colonizer.
Okay, so where shall we start with this question?
Do you think... I think we should start with, were the Hokkaido's Ainu people assimilated from your perspective?
Or do we want to introduce the Ainu people?
Yeah, we can do that first. Take us away with that.
Okay, so Ainu people were they think they're like Mongolian descended people group who came over on Shakhalin, which is that sort of weird, I was going to call it rectangular, but it's like an island north of Hokkaido that is currently owned by Russia.
Mm-hmm.
It borders on the Sea of Otsosk. Otsosk and the Sea of Japan. And the people moved down from Shakhalin to Hokkaido, mm-hmm. and lived on both islands, as well as the Kuril Islands, which are an island chain that goes up towards Kamchatka, which is that peninsula, like on the far east of Russia, far like northeast.
If you're looking at a globe, you basically have this huge island chain, and Japan actually doesn't have the whole chain. It's just got, like we talked about, the main islands. And then Russia's got the ones further north.
So this is where the Ainu people lived, and there is evidence for them living on Honshu, North Honshu as well. So Ainu people predated the Jomon period of Japan, which is... do you have any time frame for that? Is that around the... like 900s.
That sounds right. Oh no, wow. It's way earlier. The Jomon?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that's 14,000 to 300 BCE.
Okay, so they've been there a very long time.
Before Common Era.
So, as a society and as a culture, they were typically hunter-gatherers. So they wouldn't engage in agriculture. It's kind of like the hunter-gatherer or not hunter-gatherer lifestyle. And some aspects of Ainu culture include tattoos for women around the mouth, and men would they wouldn't shave. They'd have long beards, and they were given other tattoos, and they wore jewelry such as earrings and quite elaborate clothes as well, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
They were known for being animists, which means they believe that everything has a spirit, kind of like a... It's quite common in quite a lot of hunter-gatherer communities, yeah,
cultures.
Cultures, yeah, thanks. So they relied on hunting, gathering, fishing. So fishing bears, I think, had a very strong place in their society, in their the way they viewed the world. I think there was a god of bears and thunder, I think. So, yeah.
Yeah, all animals had a spiritual presence, but the bear was kind of like the top one, or the one that like really symbolized a lot for their people. Which is very common amongst like the larger and more important like carnivores in animalist societies.
Yeah, exactly. So do you want to take the story for the beginning of...
Yeah, I'll take it to the Muromachi period. So that's like 1336 to 1573. Basically, you can think of the Ainu living on like mostly Hokkaido, maybe a little bit of North Honshu, and then the Japanese more on Honshu and farther south. And you got these two communities that are very different. The Honshu are like building cities and a little bit more building their own culture that we classically think of as more Japanese today. And they're very different, right? Like the Japanese, like they're not very hairy at all, right? Whereas like these northern people are like more hunter-gatherers, like very hairy, like going out and hunting, gathering. But
I'm pretty sure hunting and gathering doesn't mean you are hairy.
No, it doesn't. I'm not saying it does. I'm just saying there were different physical appearances like as well. There were also darker skin tone I guess they weren't Japanese back then, but for what are now classically Japanese compared to the Ainu. Like every culture and every like lots of different tribes and other stuff close to each other, there's trade, right? So there's trade back and forth between these two, but there definitely was a dominance from the Japanese side, and it led to revolts. Like for example, there was the Koshamane's revolt in 1456. Where they killed the Ainu leader, Koshamane. And then we moved on to the Edo period, and it's, so that's like after 1600s, all the way up to like 1868. So there was lots of trade between the two, but it was very much separated between Hokkaido, kind of like the Ainu were on, with a little bit of Japanese presence, but not a lot. And then after like 1800, basically it became a military dictatorship, basically, the Japanese took direct control of southern Hokkaido, so where Sapporo is and most of the people who live there.
Yeah, so also just to bear in mind, in the 1800s, that's when Japan started to go through industrialization as well. And Japan was a huge uptake of industrialization. So the technological power imbalance between the Ainu people, who still remained largely hunter-gatherers, and at this point, I believe this is the beginnings of Imperial Japan, who are starting to be very technologically advanced and have this power, who have like absolute power almost in terms of technological advancements. So they do dominate further north to take control of those sort of four main islands of Japan.
And then along with like guns, germs, and steel, it was true here too. Smallpox decimated the Ainu population from Japan. That was a huge contributor. But also, like, the Japanese government at the time, through that military dictatorship, created basically like a policy of assimilation. And they did that through separating Ainu women and men. They like basically encompassed the women into their Japanese society, marrying actually Japanese men to kind of mix the bloodlines a lot more. And then they deported the men to like be merchants and subcontractors and do hard labor in different areas. And by separating it, like, they're basically trying to break up the culture and assimilate them into their own.
Yeah, so in 1869, that's when the Kaitakushi, which was sort of like their equivalent of like a development part of their government, sort of like they were in charge of developing, and they said that they changed the name of the island. So at the time it was called Ezochi, which meant uncivilized people's land. And they said, we're going to turn this into Hokkaido. So they changed the name. And that's where they banned the use of Ainu languages in schools and prohibited a lot of the cultural practices as well, such as their like hunting and their some of their gathering techniques as well. So this is sort of like a forced assimilation of the Ainu. This something that's also quite interesting is the Ainu would in some cases willingly that's probably very inaccurate. They would assimilate themselves, like find a Japanese husband or wife because it gave their children a better future. So it's certainly not willingly, but they made a decision for the future which involved losing their cultural heritage. Yeah, just the benefit of their children, basically.
And a good way to think, another good way to see this is like they were granted automatic Japanese citizenship. And you might think, oh, like, good for them, they can choose. But no, like, by basically creating that decision, they're denying them the status as an indigenous group and being who they actually are as Ainu people. So, like, that's actually the government's doing that on purpose. And the way Japan saw it is, like, it's a solution for defense, unemployment. They can send a bunch of people to go farm in Hokkaido and get more resources. So it's, like, very calculated, but completely destroys the culture as a result. And they gave a lot of the land that the Ainu, like, had been on for, I don't know, I guess, like, centuries, just as, like, farmers to Japanese, to a lot of, like, samurai from Honshu to, like, help them restart their lives. And in a lot of ways, it was like, hey, like, all the troublemakers can just go north to Hokkaido from the Japanese perspective. And, like, if they had a problem, they would just kind of maybe give them land and let them move away. And, like, they're no longer here. They're not our problem. But that land's not theirs to
get. Kind of like a penal colony.
Yeah. Although I wouldn't say it's quite as strong as a penal colony as, say, an example of Australia. Yeah, and like you said, intermarriage and offspring like was a huge part of that discrimination. In 1899, Hokkaido Former Natives Protection Act, so that was Japanese schools mandatory and the Ainu language prohibited. And then in 1945, the successful governments forced a single Japanese identity, and they kind of advocated monoculturalism. So that's kind of getting into more of the modern era of how they justified it through that monoculturalism. And Japan definitely looked back at their former history, and they basically are like, we are like, that's when we were great and we want to be like that. And so they brought a lot of that forward into the middle and late 1900s. And that's why you see a lot of like the culture of Japan being so, maybe fixed and homogenous and not being as influenced by outside cultures quite as much, such as the United States, I guess, until after the World War. But a lot of that has to do with them looking at the past and being like, we are this one group, like we have to conform to this past identity. And that identity did not include the Ainu population.
This is something that I thought we'd discuss afterwards, but it seems like a good opportunity to do it now. You say that they're not really influenced by others at this point, but arguably you could say they are taking a European rulebook of colonization, because Imperial Japan was expanding even further than Hokkaido. You know, they went to Manchuria, they went down south with the Pacific Islands. They were really in a state of expansionism, fueled by. So there's a few reasons why. Maybe would you rather talk about that now, or would you rather come back?
No, we can talk about that now. The way I see it in my mind, and tell me how you see it, is like economically, trade wise, militarily, technology. Like they're definitely like taking the best of lots of different other cultures and using that as a playbook. But I still think culturally, like within themselves, in terms of customs, they definitely were looking more at the past of historical.
But the past can fuel. So the past can fuel superiority as mm-hmm. well. So if you imagine Japan has its trade links with certain areas around the world, and they seek to have better control, so they have more favorable terms in those areas. And one of those ways you can have better control is by completely annexing it and taking mm-hmm. it. So that sort of leads you to that expansionism. But then you've also got a bunch of people that don't really want to be there
mm-hmm.
or don't want to be controlled by you. So one of the things you can do is you can bring your people in to dilute the resistance by the amount of people you've got. So then you cement your position. Maybe it's resources, maybe it's something else, and you have that. But by having this idea of we are this sort of this pan-Asian culture, we are better, we are more technologically advanced, they have a very racial superiority motives. We're clear at this sort of time. And not just from Japan, this was also a very European thing as well. And they deemed this to be like not just civilizing other places, but like their way was better, and therefore the old way, that this way that this other group did things, wasn't necessary anymore. And so they would try and assimilate that culture out so that their one true superior culture could stay and take over and expand and be better and greater and more powerful. And that's kind of what fuels a lot of this sort of like colonialism. We've seen it with loads of countries before. Obviously European were sort of like your poster children for it, but Japan was, up until the Second World War, also a major player in imperialistic expansion and racial superiority.
I think that's a good way of putting it, and goes to answering the question why they were assimilated in spades. Is there anything else you want to cover next?
So I think we should definitely cover what's happened to the Ainu now, more modern times. Have Japan actually even recognized that the Ainu people were an indigenous group?
So let's start with like present numbers to give people a perspective on like where it is now, and then we can work back from like what has changed to what's changing. Like, is it still a process of like they're still being assimilated now, or do they have a bigger voice now? Does that sound okay?
Mm-hmm.
So a good example is like in the year 2000, the number of pure Ainu was estimated to be only 300 people. And there were only 100 native speakers left of their language, which is unique. So like you can see that's like extremely low. So the assimilation has definitely been I don't want to use the word worked, but like it has happened. The total number today in 2017 is closer to like 13,000, but it's likely a lot higher because that's just recorded. And given the assimilation and given like the cross, like you could be part Ainu, right? And that's still, you might still like record yourself as part of that, which is why the number is likely also quite a bit higher. Yeah. And then the big thing is like the tide has kind of turned recently. So you want to talk a little bit about that in terms of like their rights?
So a lot of the rights changed sort of in 1997, when there was legislation to protect and promote the Ainu language and culture. Mm-hmm. I do think earlier, though, it was recognized as an ethnic minority. I think that was in 1991 that the government recognized Ainu as a, in a report to the UN, that the Ainu were an ethnic minority, but there was no recognition as an indigenous population at that point. So in 1997, the legislation was to protect and promote the Ainu language and culture. This was sort of, yeah.
And it also replaced the old 1899 law we talked about with, like, the education and, like, all those limits.
Yeah. So after they were recognized as a minority, this sort of, like, coincided with the growing voice of the Ainu in international perceptions, and obviously in domestic perceptions. So people were starting to be a bit more interested in it, a bit more proud if they were part Ainu, for example. And so they've been building on this through building museums and cultural centers to sort of promote promote the traditions and the culture. Again, it's sort of it's still sort of like slow steps at the moment, but there's now a foundation for the research and promotion of Ainu culture, which gives financial support, and it's for classes to teach the Ainu language. It's not actually still part of the curriculum, so it's got to be additional to normal learnings in Japan, like the normal curriculum. So it's like extra work still, rather than substituting something else. So I think there's also been radio programs and language speech contests as well. So they're trying to, you can see that that was started in 2006. So you can see it's all sort of like the ball is rolling. And then there's obviously like they sponsor events as well. Something else, I think there was a win very recently, Savvy. Do you want to tell me more about that?
Are you talking about the 2019 bill?
Yeah.
Yeah, so I'd love to. Which basically, so it took till 2019. This gives you a perspective of how, like, we're kind of still in the middle of this in a lot of ways, and how long it took before they were finally granted legal recognition as an indigenous group by the Japanese government. And basically, that supported their traditional culture. That museum you talked about opened during the Tokyo Olympics recently, although I'm sure it got overshadowed a little bit by the pandemic. But yeah, this is really recent. The way I see it, in terms of like the point when the tide kind of first started turning, and it's still taken like 50 plus years to like get to where we are now, is really like once World War II ended, and the UN kind of got created, there was participation, and the UN has like working groups for like kind of sub like indigenous groups within different countries, and they kind of like found their voice through that, were able to I guess accumulate power is one way to put it, but another way is just like get more recognition, spread their message, and it's definitely snowballing into like where, as you can see, like every year there's kind of more and more things recognizing them.
Yeah, and I think something else that, just to sort of put a bit of a damper on all the spirits that we've been raising here, the Ainu people still suffer discrimination through the system, where obviously things haven't changed quick. Like, obviously things have got better, but there's still a long way to go, because significantly financially lower than sort of the national average. They're less likely to go to like the top universities. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like, I don't want to say just how a lot of minorities that have been discriminated in the past, that sort of like system level discrimination,
that's a good analogy.
Takes a lot longer to shake.
Yeah. It's a good analogy, because that's true in many countries, ours included, for minorities.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so that is the end of episode number 33, or a wrap. We on covering Hokkaido in Japan. People can find us on any podcast service. You're already listening on probably the one you want to listen to on. Ambiguous Borders. It's not podcast Ambiguous Borders anymore. At Ambiguous Borders. What else can how should people best reach us, Miles?
Send us DMs on Instagram is probably the best way.
Yeah. So yeah, just give us feedback on DMs, yeah. And you can also give us feedback at the link in the description. I guess the link in the show notes.
Yeah, it'd be great to get some suggestions of what else we should answer in questions. That would be cool.
That would be cool.
I think I've learned a lot doing this. I didn't even know the Ainu existed before this, to be honest. So I've learned a lot, and I think there could be a lot more to learn from suggestions as well, if there's somewhere you want us to cover. And I guess, as they would say in the Ainu language, Apuno Paiyan.
Apuno Paiyan.